Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. Tonight I'm going to continue the topic that I started last week. You don't need to have been here last week to jump in, but we're talking about engaging with difficult people during difficult times, which is always a relevant topic, it seems like. And so last time I talked more about the kind of what I call engaged Buddhism, which is how to engage with our collective social suffering and kind of like looking at Buddhism as a way or a platform for being more active in some of the social awarenesses of our world. In the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, the Buddha says that as long as a society protects the vulnerable among them, they can be expected to prosper and not decline. And so the Buddha really emphasized engage practice, right? Like us engaging with our culture and societal issues. And he himself in his teaching heavily engaged with the caste system and kind of the oppressive structures of his day. And I really like, I talked about last time, this word anukampa, which is a Pali Sanskrit term for compassion. It's the less used term. One of the popular Pali Sanskrit terms for compassion is this word karuna, which is more of a passive compassion. But anukampa is an active word for compassion. And it literally translated means crying out at the crying of another. And so there's this part of compassion that when it sees injustice, it wants to remove those obstacles. It wants to alleviate that suffering, and it goes out to meet it where it is. And we see people like this, and we know people like this that through history or maybe even in our lives have gone out and met suffering where it is. And the fight for social justice and a lot of the inequities in our world, it takes action to resolve these conditions of suffering collectively. The Buddha says that we should direct the importance of our practice here on the cushion in the mental training of mindfulness and the commitment to non-harming for the benefit of all beings. Right? And so he says in this famous sutta, it's called the Metta Sutta, which is the teachings on loving kindness. He says, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world. And one of the 10 perfections in not the early discourses, but kind of the later afterthoughts of Buddhism, they call them the 10 perfections of the paramis, is generosity, service. And it's said and it's read in the earliest discourses when the Buddha taught his teachings to other people, the first thing he emphasized was being of service. And he said that this is a really easy way to alleviate suffering, our own and the suffering of others, is to get outside of ourselves. And then Anguttara Nikaya, one of these early discourses, the Buddha talks about the four grounds for the bonds of fellowship. He says, there are these four grounds for the bonds of fellowship: generous giving, kind words, beneficial help, and consistency. One should practice these four bonds in the face of events in line with what's appropriate in each case. These bonds of fellowship function in the world like the linchpin in a moving cart. And so he says that in a way that our ability to seek out service is what keeps our society functioning like a moving cart, right? It's what keeps the thread together. And I really love here, especially that he emphasized consistency. I was surprised that this is one of the four bonds. You know, he says, generous giving, kind words, beneficial help, and consistency. You know, showing up and doing the same thing time and time again. Maya Angelou says that this is the virtue of courage. She said there's no virtue better than courage, because without it you can't do anything time and time again. She said you can do anything erratically to be too kind or too just or too fair. She said, but to be those things time and time again demands that we have courage. And I like that. It's this kind of courage or willingness to keep showing up. And we see this in a small microcosm when we practice mindfulness, is this kind of like tendency the mind has to fall asleep into its daydreams, or literally, or fall asleep into its plans, and that's not a problem, but we have the courage to recognize and to be aware of the mind, you know, to look in and to see our inner world play out, and to have the courage to show up for that is not an easy endeavor all of the time. I always say that awareness isn't always good news, but it's always good information, right? And to have that kind of consistency with ourselves, but also to have consistency with others. So the Buddha was a really skilled teacher. And I mean that not just from my reverence for him and his teaching and him as a person or a being or enlightened person or any of that, but he was really a skilled teacher in that he was a great salesman. And so basically, I'm always looking at like, well, why should I care about some of the things that he talks about, right? Like, what's in it for me? And he says, he talks about this view of interconnection. And he says, by giving others freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression, we ourselves will enjoy freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. And so at face value, you know, that can sound so pedestrian, just hearing that. But I think there's some depth to this teaching, that when I am of service, there's something in me that recognizes the world as a place that's capable of that. It's like a reminder to myself that there's this goodwill, that there's that in the world. Especially, I talked about last time, how critical and cynical and overwhelmed, especially in our current political, social environment, I can feel at times with the nature of the suffering. You know, and by being of service, by using this anukampa, this active compassion to care for and to serve others, it's like it is a reminder that the world can be a loving and safe place. So last week I also focused on the need, as we practice service and engage in some of the more macro levels of our society and culture, to also simultaneously prioritize our own personal growth. We got to work on ourselves at the same time. You know, we need to look at our side of the street. I think some of us, being other focused, can be a bypass. You know, I'm in the helping profession, and sometimes other people's shit is a great distraction from my own. And for some of us, service can take subtle forms of manipulation or be people pleasing. Sometimes that gets in there. Sometimes it can even just get rote, and just like maybe we have a service commitment and we can do it with kind of a sour attitude at times. And last time I read this quote by Carl Jung, he said, in his language, a man whom is capable of withdrawing all of his projections knows that whatever is wrong in the world is in himself. And if he only learns to deal with his own shadow, he has done something real for the world. He has succeeded in shouldering at least an infinitesimal part of the gigantic, unresolved social problems of the day. And so what we're trying to do here is to be radically honest with ourselves about our own shortcomings, right? To look into our own mind with sometimes this kind of stark awareness, like shining a flashlight back on the person in here, right? The motivations, the reactions, the defensiveness. It's like, I like to say, it's like going into the basement with a flashlight sometimes, mindfulness is, and it's like, oh shit, I didn't know all this stuff was in here. One of my teachers, a monk named Ajahn Sachido, he says, you know, it's like kind of when you shine the flashlight, but you avoid certain corners of the basement, it's like, I don't want to look over there. And then he said that, but when you back away from a corner, it only gets darker, right? And so, like, this exploration of this inner space of, you know, how it is in here for us. What is it like in here for us? As Carl Jung calls it, the shadow side sometimes, it can be disruptive, difficult. And so as we start to look at ourselves, we can also start to look at this external mindfulness, how we relate to others. It's a huge part of, you know, in Buddhism we often are looking at if freedom, if liberation, if awakening or well-being is possible, if our personal well-being is something that we care about, what we're looking at is a lot of times what's getting in the way of that. Like, what are the things? What are the obstacles? What are the shortcomings? And one of these areas for most of us is relationships. How we relate to others. And so this is why I want to talk about tonight, mostly how to engage with difficult people. Others. And so compassion for difficult people really starts as compassion for oneself. By coming to develop more depth and caring for our own pain, we can start to care for the pain of others. Right? So it takes a little bit of, I believe, some having done the work ourselves to start to trudge into the area of being able to meet difficult people in our lives. And there's a variety of ways and privileges that we have in accessing these difficult people, which we'll talk about and hopefully have some discussion around. So if anything comes up as I talk, please bookmark it, because I want to share and hear from y'all. But I do believe compassion kind of starts with ourselves. And one of the things that we're developing here as a meditative practice is something called the heart practices, which is where you sit and you intentionally cultivate the emotional qualities of loving kindness and compassion, gratitude, and something called equanimity. You do this by actually reflecting on these qualities of mind and heart. In Buddhism, the heart and the mind are the same word. It's just called citta. It means heart, mind. Right? And so we're trying to develop a heart and a mind that has access to kindness, right? Goodwill, we could say, or non-harming. You know, that wants to have a world that is well, that has a heart that has access to pain and can empathize with. This is compassion, meeting what's hard to meet. Right? One of the things the Buddha talked about time and time again is there are some inarguable aspects of life: birth, aging, sickness, death, being separated from what's dear, losing people, gaining people, getting jobs, losing jobs, getting stability, finding ourselves insecure. Over and over again, these conditions are fleeting, impermanent. And the only wise response to loss and sorrow and the difficulty, the tragedy that we experience, is compassion. It's the one gift that we have, is that we can care, that we do care. And sometimes our care comes out in dysfunction. Sometimes the ways that we care makes things worse. And so we all care. I think at our base that seed is in there. And so we can develop compassion. We've got to start by developing that and turning that internally. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, he's a monk and Buddhist scholar, says that the procedure starts with oneself. If we look into our own mind, we find that the basic urge of our being is the wish to be happy and free from suffering. Now, as soon as we see this in ourselves, we can immediately understand that all living beings share the same basic wish. All want to be well, happy, and secure. To develop compassion towards others, what is to be done is to imaginatively share their own innate wish for happiness. We use our own desire for happiness as the key. Experience this desire as the basic urge of others, then come back to our own position and extend to them the wish that they may achieve their ultimate objective, that they may be well and happy. Some of the most difficult people in our lives, and I want to start with these people, some of the most difficult people in our lives are those whom we love the most, right? The frenemies or the family enemies. And so this is often a good starting point for practicing compassion towards difficult people, mostly because we know that we have things in these people that we love. Right? There are the glaring shortcomings and annoyances and frustrations and boundary steppings that continue to happen with these people. But we know with these frenemies and with our family enemies that, for some of them, that we have something in them, in our relationship with them, that we love. So we can start there, as Bhikkhu Bodhi says, and we can start to expand from that place. And so I want to talk about a few things. I'm interested in what y'all have to share here in a little bit, too. How do we start to practice compassion towards these close, difficult people? And the first, I love this, is one I often overlook, is just to try to practice some acceptance to love the difference in between ourselves and another. Right? That there are differences, that we are unique, that some of our uniqueness is annoying and frustrating, and that we can't control those differences, that some people just have some functions of personality that rub us the wrong way, and we can learn to love the difference in between us. And again, this doesn't complete the picture. It's just kind of one aspect of working with close, difficult people, is how can we practice some acceptance that this person is who they are? Because oftentimes in our attempts to control them, we want them to be, or to act the way that we need them to act, right? That the suffering is kind of in that control, in the lack of acceptance. And Rilke has a really great poem about this. He says, "Once the realization is accepted that even between the closest people, infinite distances exist, a marvelous living side by side can grow up for them. If they succeed in loving the expanse between them, which gives them the possibility of always seeing each other as a whole and before an immense sky." And so he says that even between the closest people, infinite distances exist. If they succeeded in loving the expanse between them, there's the possibility of seeing each other as a whole. Because some of our differences is what makes relationships special. You know, and sometimes the thing about my wife that annoys me on one day is the thing that I find endearing in her personality the next day. You know? Right? It keeps me honest. It keeps me practicing with my own shit, my control issues. You know, it helps me to stay humble and practice some surrender. And so this is one aspect, I think, of working, especially with the close, difficult people, is like loving the distance in between us. Another part is looking at our part. And so how do we have a part in the difficulty that exists there? However small our part may be, I think there's something incredibly powerful about this intention, this investigation, really looking into, hey, I wonder what my part or piece of this dynamic is. Owning one side of the street means taking responsibility and seeing that we have some agency, even if it's just in changing how we relate to them. Maybe my part is I really suck at upholding boundaries. Shit. You know, or maybe my part is when we bicker, I do the same thing that they do, right? I kind of like fall into the same pattern. Another way of working with difficulties is the Buddha talks about, very traditional, is practicing wise communication, right? Nonviolent communication. Because with these people, we care about these people. And so what if my intention as I communicate with them is that I have compassion at the forefront? And I say, okay, Andrew, I have to kind of sit down and give myself a pep talk and be like, ultimately, I care about this person. That's why this pisses me off so bad. That's why this is so painful. That's why this is so hard. Because I care and I can't seem to work it out. And so what if compassion was at the forefront? It might change the way that I speak and communicate with them. The Buddha offers kind of four guidelines and ways of being in communication with people in general, is to ask yourself the question in the moment as a meditative practice, is what I'm saying, is what I'm sharing, is it true or is it authentic? Is it honest? So truth is one aspect. Is it useful? Meaning, does it add to? Is it needed? Is it timely? Is it the right time? Or do I say something vindictive and really shitty, like right as they're leaving the door, right? Or right as I have to head off to work or whatever it may be? Is it timely? Is it the right time? And is it kind? And so kindness is not niceness. Kindness means that I can say things keeping in mind that I love this person, right? And I can say things and practice saying things keeping in mind that I value the relationship. And so some of us also have difficulty with conflict avoidance. So it's what we don't say that causes some of the problems in communication. You know, so it's we have a hard time really, maybe in the first place, understanding what our needs are or kind of investigating what our part is. Like, we could back up a couple steps and say, okay, I have to accept that this person's different and I can't control them. And then B, I have to practice looking at my part, and now I have to actually address that there's some needs here, right? There's something that's not quite fleshing out for me, and I need to really practice being confrontational in a healthy way. Some of us need to be more avoidant of conflict. Right? And so it's all about kind of like, these are just awarenesses and investigative kind of areas to practice. It's like, oh man, I like to really argue, and that's kind of my go-to. Maybe I need to jump back and practice acceptance and look at my part. Right? Or maybe some of us really shut down around having the conflict, and so we need to jump in and do it and speak it and share it. Socrates says, I've noticed that anyone who is to form a right judgment must have three qualities: understanding, goodwill, and readiness to be perfectly frank. One of the things I think that upsets, and not so much upsets, but derails us from making connections in difficult experiences, is our ability to deal with the discomfort of conflict, debate, and confrontation, and some of these things that are hard to do. You know, and to say, hey, I'm wrong, and oh man, that didn't come out how I meant it, and give me a second, let me think about what I just said, or I'm really activated right now, I need to take a moment to breathe, and, you know, like staying in the process together. Wise communication. And then the fourth, one way to practice with difficult people is, of course, setting boundaries. Right? And for some of us, maybe, like, as they hear that, it's like, oh yeah, okay, That's a needed part too, because some of these difficult people, we can let them into our heart, we can care about them, but we can't let them into our home, right? We got to keep a firm boundary, because they step and we've gotten hurt. Here's the thing about boundaries: it's not up to other people to uphold our own boundaries. Our boundaries are our boundaries, and we can, it's almost like I'm wearing glasses, I'm the only one can see them. And so when they come up, I have to say, actually, there's a boundary there. And if you're in here, X, Y, and Z needs to happen now, right? Because that's what I set up. That's the boundary. And this is what I see with myself and with people that I work with, some of my therapy clients, is they say, hey, I set the boundary, right? And they'll come back and they'll be like, I told my mom she can't call me at 1 a.m. when she's drunk. But then she did it, you know? I say, okay, well, what was the boundary? Well, you know that I am not going to talk to her for so long if that happens again, or whatever it may be, right? That's upholding the boundary. And then practicing forgiveness, of course. I think this is a very valuable practice. And again, it's about forgiveness from a Buddhist perspective is more about forgiving the actor than the action. Some actions, I believe, are unforgivable. They're wrong. They're harmful. They're unjust. Objectively, they don't promote well-being. But understanding that suffering and confusion comes and spills out and creates more suffering and confusion, and that forgiveness is often more for ourselves than for the other person, is learning how, and as an investigation and a practice, is how do we meet someone with not agreeing with the actions, but letting go of the resentment, right? And I think this is a hard thing, because for me it's like a constant practice. It's like I don't just forgive someone one time. It's like, oh, I forgive. It's like, oh, shit. You know, I have a friend of mine that, a really close friend of mine, that had a little bit of a falling out with recently, and he said a lot of hurtful things to me. And it's taken us like a couple months, and like the cool thing is that we both care about each other, right? So it's like we're in it and we're talking about it, and my conflict avoidance, I've been working on that, and I bring it back up. I'm like, hey, I just want to check in around this for a little bit. Like, this is what's how I'm feeling about it now. And you know, and like, and I accept your apology. He apologized to me, you know, a little while ago, and reminding myself, I accept your apology. I'm working to forgive you. And so some of the things I might say is like, I'm still hurt, but I am practicing forgiveness, and I do accept your apology, if it's true, right? And I am still hurt. Like, both of those things are still true. Or I may need to limit our time together for a while, but I do accept your apology, and I do want to mend the pain that was caused by this experience. You know, and so there's like this element of like navigating the gray area here with us in our relationships and practicing forgiveness. One of the things that I really like, if and when this is possible, again, we have to kind of take into reason who these people are. I think rating, like, there are the 10 people, and maybe we don't even touch the 10 people, like the people that have caused us a lot of harm. They're maybe off the table of this whole conversation. You know, we'll maybe get back to them later. Start with the 10-pound weights, right? We'll just like build a little strength up and see where things go over time. It's a gradual practice. Yeah, but one of the things that I like is like verbally practicing apologizing and making amends. You know, this is a part of being a person in recovery, was a part of my recovery practice, was like to really write down a list of people I'd harmed and the ways that I had harmed them, and to own my part and to ask them for forgiveness and to see if there's anything they needed from me to move towards that. Right? And so I had an experience with my dad where I went on a trip with him, and it was the right time. I didn't want to admit it was the right time, but it was like the perfect time. It was just me and him chilling, nowhere to go, nothing to do. And I needed to share like a lot of shit with him. And I did. And I actually was so nervous, I kind of brought this piece of paper with me and I just read it, right? And my dad is a very like stoic person, right? So I kind of knew what his reaction was going to be. I envision him saying something like, yeah, you know, I really appreciate that. of course, I forgive you. You're my son. I'm just proud of you. And I read through this whole, these like couple pages of paper, and I looked up, and he had tears pouring down his face, and he said, thank you. And that's all he said. And it was just like, he needed to hear that. And I had no clue. Part of me was like, he's fine. Like, I don't have to bring this up or trudge this out. It's uncomfortable for him. It's uncomfortable for me. You know, but he said, thank you. And there was something about that that really was powerful for me. And being able to verbally try to mend a relationship. And to even just kind of start in that direction. So now I want to talk just for a moment about the really difficult people. Especially, I talked about engaging with difficult people in difficult times. And so there are people that we experience and come across in our lives to varying degrees of privilege that they actually are unsafe for us to engage with and be around. And then there are the difficult people of politics and the difficult people of different views and opinions and religious beliefs. And a lot of these views and opinions can be unsafe for some of us, right? To be around and interact with these people. And for some of us, it's a great opportunity to engage, you know, and to speak up and to, you know, to approach the difficult. And so the one of the distinctions here is kind of like looking at the difference between anger, which is a justified, completely naturally occurring, evolutionarily uploaded emotion that we have, and hatred, which is when hatred is when anger solidifies and fixates. The emotion of anger is like an evolutionary indicator that there's some perceived threat, right? So anger is like appropriate and needed and gives us energy to set boundaries and to express needs and to stand up to injustice. Hatred is a poison. It's something that festers and lives in the heart. It materializes as this like view, you know, in this position. And the Buddha, you know, famously, part of our practice is like trying to uncover what hatred lies in our heart. You know, these kind of the hatred that's built out of wounds, of oppression for some, of being marginalized, of attachment wounds, of being abandoned, neglected, betrayed. You know, that the hatred of the heart is a hardened kind of part of what's in here. And we're trying to, as the Buddha says, understand that hatred doesn't cease by hatred. Right? One of the famous kind of, especially in the Tibetan form of Buddhism, the mantras is hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. Hatred as a whole doesn't get us anywhere. Anger does. Anger can also be destructive. The Buddha calls anger the honey-tipped dart because it's sweet, right? Sometimes anger is like, it gives us the passion, you know, to like engage in the conflict. Some of us that aren't so good at doing it and having confrontation is like, once the anger comes out, it's like Pandora's box is open. We just charge forward to set every boundary that was never set in the past, to do it now. And so the road to compassion for really difficult people is a road. And one of the things is like just an inquiry, a practice of, can I hate these people less? Right? And one of the kind of things that I'll ask is like, I wonder if this person has any seed of goodwill in their heart. I wonder if that's in them. I wonder when that got covered up for them I wonder what happened to them. I wonder if they struggle with mental illness. I wonder if their insecurities were bullied and picked on. Yeah, and that's what they learned. And it doesn't excuse the action, but it helps me to understand the actor. You see, so it's like, can I hate the person less while still having anger towards the injustices that maybe they commit? Hating less is a road towards compassion. It's like sometimes it's just we have to start there. It's like, all right, I hate this fucking person, but can I hate them a little bit less? And then we can practice also another way of practicing here is like mercy. Maybe this is someone we know. And mercy is an interesting word, but it's just when you don't try to make it worse. So it's not even tolerance. So you don't even tolerate the person. You just try to not add our hate fuel to their fire. You know, maybe we don't ridicule or gossip or having some of these kind of, we know they're destructive behaviors for us. You know, and like having mercy means that like, all right, their actions are bad enough. Like, do I need to go in and put my badness in there too with them? You know, do I need to get my own shit in there? And of course, this is kind of different for different people because sometimes we do want to be disruptive to things that are hateful. So it's tricky. But mercy means that you can still hate, but you don't add extra fuel to the fire. Tolerance. They're a person, they do exist. I maybe don't even need to exist around them, but they're here. And we can move towards compassion, which is I care about them, I wish for them to be free from suffering. Even if I don't agree with their actions, I wish for them to be free from suffering. In this life, in many lives, lives down the road, may they do one thing in this life that's a seed of goodwill. You know, that maybe through thousands of incarnations wandering this earth, they may wake up. And so here's one thing that I've noticed, is that it's harder to practice compassion towards people that are more distant to us. And so this is one of the difficulties of having, you know, having a kind of our technology distance us and having the separation from these people that cause suffering is because we don't get to see seeds of goodwill. You know, we don't actually know the people. You know, this person wakes up with aches and pains just like I do. You know, and that this person feels a burden just like I do. You know, and that this person has the inevitability of death and loss in their life, just like I do. There's some aspects of like what touches me that touches them.